Good afternoon. Welcome to today's Community and Regional Affairs hearing. With me today is Senator Wagner, Senator Kukes, Senator Menard, and myself, Senator Olson. Please turn off all your cell phones and Blackberries. This meeting is being teleconferenced and recorded. Today, the committee will consider the confirmation of Governor Parnell's appointment of Susan Bell to be the Commissioner of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. The committee will then hear from the Department of Natural Resources about the Alaska Coastal Management Program. Commissioner Bell, before we get to the question, I'd like to have the opportunity to tell for you to tell us your background and professional experience and why you were tapped on the shoulder for this very important position.
Thank you.
That we don't take lightly. So with that, Commissioner.
Thank you. Susan Bell, as been mentioned, I'm the Commissioner for the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. Prior to taking this position in July, when Commissioner Noddy resigned, I was working in the Governor's office as a special assistant, working primarily with the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development, but I also spent time with Department of Revenue on issues and Department of Administration. That was about 18 months ago. It was late September 2009 when I entered the Governor's office, and it was a great opportunity to become familiar with the issues and the people and some of the goals of the department. Before that, I was a principal with McDowell Group. It's a research and consulting firm. I was based here in Juneau. There's offices in Anchorage, and there's been other small offices in the past. And the firm gave me a great opportunity to work statewide on issues that relate to many of the issues that I'm working on now, economic development at the community and private sector level, a lot of community development and planning, and a chance to work with a number of state agencies, including Department of Commerce, Department of Transportation. We did a lot of transportation planning projects, and we're particularly involved in the economic analysis as well as the public outreach. So, again, many of the issues that I worked on prior, I was with McDowell Group for 8.5 years. Many of the issues are still directly relevant to the things that we're working with now. Before that, I was one of the vice presidents working with Joe Beadle at Gold Belt, and again, was a unique opportunity to work both with an organization that was very focused on economic development, on job creation, on shareholder hire, but within the context of the ANCSA Corporation, a unique institution here in Alaska that has a lot of cultural and social values as part of its core fabric and its culture. So I was there for 3 years. I also have a lot of business management and marketing experience and have lived and worked throughout the state. And as several of you know, my family roots are deep in the Nome area. I was raised in Fairbanks, went through the school system there, and have worked and lived throughout the state, with the last 20 or so years being in Southeast. I've been in Juneau, Ketchikan, Haines, and Skagway. So is that a sufficient overview? Thank you.
Any questions by members of the committee for the commissioner designee? Sarah Wagner.
Commissioner, your department administers the Regional Seafood Development Program, which is in Bristol Bay, I believe. They assess, similar to the Aquaculture Association, they assess 1%, which your department, I believe, distributes and oversees. One of these organizations given money from the commercial salmon fishermen to Trout Unlimited, and I just wonder how you track those type of I don't know whether it's a grant or a gift or whatever, but it, just how does that fit into their overall goals as far as a regional seafood development program, giving money from fishermen to an organization that's basically an advocacy organization for environmental issues nation and worldwide.
Through the chair, Senator Wagner, thank you for giving me an opportunity to speak to this. This is an issue that in our department in the last week, in both the Division of Economic Development and in the Commissioner's Office, had come to our attention. We're talking with the Department of Law, and you are correct. We do have the regulatory and oversight responsibility for these marketing organizations. I believe 7 are established in statute, but 2 have been created. It's a voluntary decision by the fishermen in the area, and Bristol Bay has one, and Copper River has another. But there is greater opportunity for more to be formed. And so one of the things we're doing is talking directly with the RSDA as well as with Department of Law to understand One, what was the expenditure? Two, what is the authority? Were they using funds that were, you know, did they have alternative means of raising funds? Were they using funds that were generated through this tax? And even if they were, what's the appropriate response? So appreciate you raising the question. And just in the course of the last couple of days, we have begun to look into it ourselves. As we do make a determination, I'm happy to reply back through the full committee on what.
If you would, I'd appreciate receiving the report. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And yeah, we want to welcome Senator Ellis to the committee this afternoon. Senator Ellis, we've just gone through a short introduction to Commissioner Designee Bell. Do you have any questions of the new commissioner?
Not at this time. Thank you.
Any other members have questions of the Commissioner Designee? I'm sorry, Senator Menard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just start out by just saying you're obviously a very accomplished woman, and I am so appreciative that you have been brought forward by the governor to be a commissioner of this arena. But, you know, you've got roots from Nome to Fairbanks to, you know, the McDowell, and I just am in awe of all you've accomplished, and lucky us that you're before us today. It's just
thank you.
I do have a question. Thank you for being here. It's been a pleasure to work with you. And I have some folks, some constituents, interested parties that were involved in the citizens, the statewide head tax on the cruise industry. And I know there we were very happy to see the announcement that some of the, that there was an uptick in folks coming back to Alaska, people that had deployed their ships out of Alaska, whether as a pressure tactic, a business tactic, whatever it was, in the marketplace. Are there and there were a number of cruise lines that announced an increase before the head tax was partially rolled back. Can you give us an update on what's going on there with the market? Have any cruise lines returned ships since the passage of the rollback in the head tax?
Through the chair, Senator Ellis, I appreciate that question. We knew about this time last year that we were going to be seeing the entrance of Disney Cruise Line and the return of Crystal to the Alaska market. One of the things that happened shortly after the session ended, and I think it was about June of last summer, was that a very high-end cruise line, small line Oceana, announced that they'd be coming to Alaska this summer. So we had news of what will be less than 10,000 passengers, but very much welcomed, because we saw in the neighborhood of 150,000 cruise passengers drop from Alaska. And that was on the heels of 125,000 lost independent visitors, so a very significant hit. So, again, shortly after the session ended, Oceana announced they were coming to Alaska last fall. Princess announced that they were going to return a cross-Gulf ship to Alaska in 2012. So we won't see it this summer. We'll see it next year. And I make an emphasis on the cross-Gulf ship because many of those passengers spend time in Alaska on their own, or they opt to purchase a cruise tour either through their line or other tour companies. So, again, there's greater opportunity for economic benefits to the state with a cross-Gulf ship. We also had the governor, myself, and a number of Alaska businesses and communities were at Cruise Shipping Miami just a couple of weeks ago, Holland America announcing that also for 2012 they were making some increases in capacity, and we'll see not a whole new ship, but in some additional voyages, we'll see another 11,000 passengers. So, again, what does that mean in terms of numbers? We lost nearly 150,000 this year. This year is almost going to be flat. I'd mentioned Oceana, Disney, and Crystal, but we already knew about some other losses, so it'll just be a little bump. Next year, we'll see in the neighborhood of 60,000 new passengers back into the market. That's still a long way from the 150,000 or so that we lost. And then you had referenced this as well. We're seeing from early research from the Alaska Travel Industry Association, they were asked to measure the effectiveness of the additional funds from last year. They're seeing an increase in visitors for this summer. So again, we're recovering, but not all the way back to the nearly 260,000 or so that we lost in a 2-year period.
Follow up, Senator Ellis?
Sure. And Ms. Bell, would you, I mean, wasn't a lot of the follow-up due to the worldwide economic situation as opposed to the head charge? And because other, I mean, a number of cruise lines were announcing coming to Alaska when we had the citizen-inspired head tax. I know there was a company or two that said they would take their toys and go home and sort of economically leveraged us in a sense, and now they've built back some capacity, but we're regaining largely due to the recovery in the worldwide economy, aren't we?
Through the chair. Senator Ellis, I absolutely agree that we as a state and many of our businesses were affected by the economic decline. That was, you know, it was a precipitous drop in visitation. Also, what we had was with the passage of the ballot initiative, several things. One of them was, at the time, a suite of nearly $70 million in new taxes and fees, plus taking what were already very high standards in the world in terms of environmental regulations, the Ocean Ranger program. So there was an operational effect. And there's also a message that's sent by having a majority of our citizens that voted approve that ballot initiative. So it was a combination of fees, in addition to the economic decline that I agree that really affected us in 2009, the combination of fees, message, and operational issues, I in my opinion, contributed significantly to the decline that we had and that's been something that the dialogue between not only the governor but the communities and businesses that have gone to Cruise Shipping Miami the last 2 years and the conversation that's ensued in that period, there's been a lot more dialogue. I think that the recovery that we're seeing is a combination of not just the rollback in fees but that outreach. I think that goes a long way. We were, you know, as you well recall, in a lawsuit with a cruise line. So being able to put that behind us, being able to increase our marketing and to reach out and say we value your business, coupled with the changes last year in the fee structure, I think all of that goes hand in hand in restoring the market.
And I appreciate the response. I would just comment that Alaskans generally are quite proud of our pristine waters and our clean air here. I think that's what the companies are marketing, Alaska's wilderness and unique nature and our communities and the clean air and the clean water. I think that's a big attraction. So that's something to be proud of. And did you, in the conversations that you and the governor had there in Miami, was there an opportunity for you all to ask the industry for support for the tourism marketing program here? And, you know, in the old days, the cruise ship folk, when we required the contribution from the industry, it wasn't such a little secret, but the cruise ship folks purchased the ads, a lot of the big ads, display ads in the Vacation Planner, and sort of had that industry input into our generic marketing program. And then at a certain point, they decided they were just going to market themselves and not really market Alaska, or market Alaska to the benefit of the cruise lines, not for the generic marketing program that Alaska invented as a model and many other communities and states and countries have emulated to great success. So was there an opportunity to ask the folks that are making money off of us to help kick in for marketing that benefits more than just the cruise industry?
Through the chair, Senator Ellis, the main message, both from an opportunity to speak to the full convention delegates, which I think neighborhood in the was in the thousands, as well as the one-on-one and small group meetings that the governor had with the cruise lines, were about what Alaska's doing in terms of wanting to ensure that we have a robust marketing program, wanting to be sure that they understood the changes that were made to the fee structure and our commitment, as you said, to high environmental standards, but looking for practical ways that we can use things like the technology and environmental monitoring. So it was more a message, as I was talking about, in terms of outreach and welcoming. Just to briefly mention, you were talking about Alaska and we serving as a model. I previously was on the Alaska Tourism Marketing Council as a representative of Southeast Alaska Tourism Council. That's going back about 15 years in a prior iteration, but Alaska's public-private partnership has stood out. But to answer your question directly, the conversations were more about Alaska wanting to restore that business and our welcome mat being open and the changes we've made.
And they didn't volunteer to help us with our marketing effort money-wise?
Through the chair, Alaska's marketing program and the strength of it and the quality of it affects all of our businesses, and they've said that you know, the cruise lines all the way down to you know, small B&Bs and tour operators that, you know, that participate in the program. It's heavily leveraged by communities and businesses, but no, there was not a, as you said, a voluntary offering. They do, however, participate as members and do buy ads and labels and other things that, that all businesses have access through the pay-to-play programs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions? Senator Wagner.
Over the last two or three years, we've seen an erosion of population in the rural areas moving into town. Has that declined any, or is that still going on? What's your perception from what you see where you sit, because you deal with these rural areas quite often?
Through the chair, Senator Wagner, one thing that I know, having, yeah, from my work outside of the state, particularly 2 years ago, at, you know, as we were heading into, you know, fall and winter of 2008, 2009, we had the very high gas prices. There was a lot of media attention on people moving from the rural areas, particularly into Anchorage. And at that time, the rural subcabinet was created. One of the things that we've, there's been not only analysis of fuel costs and distribution systems, but also analysis of population trends. And one of the things that was clear was after that initial spike is that there's very clearly a movement, a very fluid movement, you know, to and from our rural areas. But as you say, there is, you know, there is a concern that we have the community stability, the safety, and the economic viability out to preserve our communities and preserve our Alaska and our way of life. One of the things that we've been doing in the course of the last few months as we're all settling into our new roles, myself as Commissioner of Commerce, Commissioner Sullivan, who had been the Attorney General and the Chair of the Subcabinet, now, of course, at DNR, is working on completing a study that a plan that really documents what was learned through that process, through the rural subcabinet, particularly through some extensive outreach and travel to rural Alaska, but also to not only document it, but to work on an implementation plan in terms of the recommendations we have to the governor and the legislature. So it's a bit of a transition because we also moved the chairmanship, or the governor moved the chairmanship from the Attorney General to our department, and we thought that was a natural way to focus on implementation. So you're right. We also have the fresh census data, and we've been looking at that, particularly Department of Labor and our community and regional affairs staff, because so much of our funding formulas are based on population as well. So we've got a very big focus on it, and ultimately it's not just to measure the numbers, it's to make sure that we get back to our mission of strong communities and a healthy and diverse economy that allows people to stay in their homes.
Thank you.
Any further questions by members of the committee? Now, I guess I have a couple questions for you. One is, what do you see as the vision for your department as you look out toward the future for this very important department, obviously, especially with the rural aspect to it?
Well, thank you for the question. And one of the things that we've been talking about within the department and with the legislature in the last couple of months is the fact that our community and regional affairs department had recently grown and had strengthened particularly our staff and our field offices. One of the things that I think is important to do, and it's been a focus that even preceded me coming into the commissioner role, is really strengthening and retooling our economic development division so that we can work hand in hand. One of the things that we've talked about a lot with legislators in the last couple of months is the complementary relationship between community and regional affairs and our economic development divisions and other entities that are housed within the department, such as Alaska Energy Authority, and how we can collaborate. But really thinking about the vision, I am really looking forward to working with, we've got a number of very talented and very dedicated staff to really be as effective as possible in our program delivery, to look for ways where we can be more efficient and serve Alaska residents, businesses, and communities better by working collaboratively across our department and with other departments. And, you know, each day we take our mission, again, back to strong communities and healthy communities and strong economy, making sure that we are effective in our program delivery. So, again, I feel like we do have a department that has the potential to really provide a leadership for businesses and communities, and I really feel a strong desire from myself and from the division directors and the staff to really achieve that potential fully. And as I said last year, with some reorganization and some additional resources, I felt like the Community and Regional Affairs Division grew in strength, and I feel like we're trying to mirror that so that we can be as effective in the economic development side as well.
Okay. As I was reminded by a previous commissioner this a few hours ago when I had a meeting, that commissioners come and commissioners go, and it's part of the political process that goes on. But as you look at that, what do you want your legacy to be? As people say, you know, Commissioner Bell, this is the whatever. What do you see that you want to try and accomplish through that?
Thank you. There's two areas. Again, I was talking about retooling our economic development and thinking about our trade. I think there is an urgency. Again, we have a day-to-day capacity building in community relations or in our community and regional affairs department. But I feel like our economic development functions had shrunk in recent years, mm-hmm. and that's an area where I feel like a legacy can be built that that with our trade and with our economic strength, we can turn something that this last year Alaska was ranked 50th out of 50th in looking at other states in terms of our competitiveness, and I think we have so much to offer in terms of our people, our location, our resources, and our innovation, and turning that around. So, again, we've got other aspects of the department that are part of strengthening the business community, and that's our consumer protection elements, working hand in hand to be effective in that and really advancing Alaska in terms of our economic position. It is really one of the key areas that I'm focused on.
You want to comment on expanding the department, whether you see expanding under your watch or... I guess here's the question that I really have, is that as we look at what's going on with rural areas are mainly, I would say a large part are along the coastline and are really involved or have been very much affected by the Alaska Coastal Management Program. That's obviously what we're going into after we're done with our interaction with you. We're going to be looking at that program. Now, there's obviously been a fair amount of dissatisfaction that has happened since 2003 with it being under the Department of Natural Resources. So we as policymakers have looked at the possibility of taking it out of that department and putting it into another department. It's pretty evident that it's my understanding that the Department of Environmental Conservation does not want the program. And what has been looked at is that the people have looked to your department that you've been named to possibly take over this program that has been so so dependent or on and looked at by those communities that are out there. What are your thoughts on that as we look at this?
Well, to be candid, I hadn't realized that.
And you have the option of not answering the question.
I hadn't realized that our department had been contemplated as a possible home for that. I do want to say, since I know when the subject comes up, that I won't be able to speak to it, that in the course of the last, you know, even in the short time in the new year with Commissioner Sullivan, with our respective deputy commissioners, mm-hmm. particularly Joe Balash and Curtis Thayer, and our directors, I really want to compliment the efforts that we've done down to the division director level in our department, of course, Scott Ruby, Randy Bates, and DCOM, that we realize that we're working with a department that I think can draw on, or we're working with a program that can draw on strengths of each of our departments. We've got contacts, we've got technical knowledge, we've got, it's one of those areas where some of the frustration, I feel like we've made great strides in a short amount of time to work through it, to ensure that communities have their funds, and to just elevate and focus on what we should be accomplishing with the program. So I'm not prepared to comment on our ability to to house that, I just want to say that our working relationship has strengthened even in the course of the last few weeks, and I think there are things that each department and each division has to offer to the program. In terms of growing the department initially, when you posed the question, I think the first thing we have to do is just look at how can we be can we be more effective with the resources that we have? And I think the answer is yes.
Okay. Well, on behalf of the communities that are out there, we want to thank you for stepping up to the plate and allowing these grants to go through and be expedited out to those management plans that are there. So, if there's no further questions by members of the committee, thank you very much for coming before us this afternoon. Next, we have the Alaska Coastal Management Program. I'm sorry. We don't have anybody online, do we? Let's call it that. Let's bring it at ease here. Get back on record. We'll entertain a motion at this time, Senator.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move that we forward the name of Commissioner Designee Commissioner Bell to the full body for confirmation.
Any objections? No. Not. We'll move around then. Thanks. At ease. On the record, welcome to the Community Regional Affairs, Joe, Mr. Balash. As we look at Alaska Coastal Zone Management Plan, I think I want to go ahead and get an overview on this because of the issues that have been out there, some of the things that have been positive, some of the things that have been negative, but I guess on behalf of the people that are out there in the state of Alaska that have been under this program, we want to just thank you for what you've done in the past. It's my understanding that you were the main, one of the main authors of the bill that put the sunset provision there in place of this in the next couple months. So this review is obviously because of the sunset. So since you're the engineer of that, we want to thank you for putting that in there. With that, go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Joe Balash. I'm the Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Natural Resources. I am here today representing the Department of Natural Resources, and Commissioner Sullivan asked that I express his apologies for not being here in person. He would have preferred to do that, but was leading the Choose Respect March and Rally in Fairbanks today and unable to make it. So it is he would have preferred to make the first presentation to this committee by the department his own, but not able to do that. What I want to do for the committee here today is talk a little bit about the governor's legislation. He did submit a request to extend the program. I look forward to I saw the notice for next week and look forward to talking about that bill formally. But the program itself has really two main components and processes to it that I think we'll get to spend some time talking about next week. And for background purposes, want to highlight those key parts. The first I'll talk about is the planning process, the planning process that the state and communities go through to develop very specific plans for each community or district around the state. And then I'd like to spend some time then talking about the implementation of that plan and program through the consistency review process that the state division or one of our divisions, Division of Coastal and Ocean Management, uses to review projects as part of the overall regulatory scheme we have here in Alaska. And so hopefully we'll be able to talk about each of those respective pieces. They're very different, but they are interconnected and interdependent. So with that, Mr. Chairman, the highlights here of the program. The federal structure for it is the Coastal Zone Management Act, a federal law enacted back in 1972 that allows states to develop their own coastal programs. And, you know, it's something that's voluntary on the part of states to implement in a variety of ways. Alaska's implementation is just one of those three ways. The Technique A is a locally implemented program structure where, as in Oregon, the state develops the standards and then allows the locals to implement and issue the permits and conditions. Technique B is where it's just a state standardized program where the state issues the permits and there is no real local involvement. A single standard applied throughout. And then Technique C is a hybrid of those where communities are involved in the development of the standards and the planning and also involved in the issuance of permits. And that is something that is actually unique to Alaska. We are the only state in the nation that that has adopted Technique C for implementation. So the program itself here in Alaska is a networked program. It is dependent upon coastal participation by the communities, and that input and involvement is an important feature. Understand, of course, that a number of communities and districts are frustrated with the process that is in place today. We'll talk about some of those things as we dig into some of the details here. But the rules for that local participation are set out in the statute and implemented then in the regulations. So around the state, we have a variety of communities and regions throughout that have adopted or chosen to become districts formally under the program. And not all communities participate. It is voluntary on the community part. And when communities choose to form a coastal district, they do not necessarily have to adopt a local plan, but that is going to be the next part that we talk about. Communities can participate as reviewing entities without necessarily having a coastal plan of their own. The process for developing or amending a local coastal plan is quite lengthy and involves a number of steps, but importantly involves a tremendous amount of input and comment by all stakeholders. They're in the communities, but also from the broader economic interests that seek to operate in those communities. And those hearings and processes go through a variety of stages here and reviews by the department and the division staff. And what I would highlight for you is down on the last row there at the bottom, where the first box, DCOM has 15 days to release the final findings and conclusions. The next box is where the commissioner approves or disapproves the amendment. In between there is an opportunity for mediation, and that has been used by some communities, and it has been used effectively by some communities, but it's also met with impasse in other situations. And so what I don't want to go through each and every box. I don't think that's the kind of detail we need to go into today, but this is a lengthy process. It can take 2 to 3 years to complete, and so the planning process is deliberate and does take time. And I would just note for the members, there is another box there on the bottom row where federal review and approval is required as part of the process before the local plan becomes final. The Coastal District Plan approval process that we just talked about it contains a tremendous amount of information. They are very useful to anybody seeking to operate in the coastal zone, but the most important parts of that plan are the enforceable policies, the enforceable components of that plan, including the enforceable policies, designated areas where those enforceable policies apply, and maps that spell out where those designated areas are. And the enforceable policies are governed by a set of statutes and regulations. And the statutory requirements were a big part of legislation that was considered by the legislature and adopted back in 2003. And some of the highlights there indicate for the committee here include that the local plan shall not duplicate, restate, or incorporate by reference statutes or regs adopted by a state or federal agency, that the policy use clear and concise language, that it use precise, prescriptive, and enforceable language, and do not address a matter adequately addressed by state or federal law. Now, I just used the word adequately, and adequately, unfortunately, is a word that results in a subjective determination made by somebody as to whether or not state or federal regulation governing the particular resource or policy in question, the adequacy of that is determined in this case by DCOM in consultation with the respective agencies. A number of districts have been frustrated by that determination process and are seeking to remove that particular language one way or another, and we'll have an opportunity to talk about that next week, I think. So I did want to highlight that, though, for the committee. On designated areas, a community can develop or select a designated area to apply a local enforceable policy. And a designated area is important because when you develop an enforceable policy for the local level, it is an additional hurdle or set of requirements that a project sponsor or developer has to meet in order to move forward with that activity in the coastal zone. And so designating the area where that policy applies is part of the current program. I would note that a designated area does not require a local enforceable policy. Where designated areas are inserted in the local plans, that does give the community then the opportunity to enjoy deference in the consistency review process, even when they're relying on the state standards rather than their own. So that's something we'll talk about when we go through the consistency review process flowchart, but I just wanted to mention that here.
How many designated areas are there out there with approved plans?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that we have two districts without approved plans. And if memory serves, the audit that was conducted by the legislative auditor this past fall concluded stated that 70% of the designated area requests were approved in the planning process. I'm not sure what that number is, but I'd be happy to get that for the committee.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead, continue.
And then finally, the maps that reflect the designated areas themselves are an important part of that local plan, because it's important for people operating in the coastal zone to know whether they are in a designated area or not, and which policies then apply to their activity or project. So there's a number of overlapping rules and guidelines, and that's just in the statutes. You then, when you follow through into the regulations, the particulars get more specific. And in order to assist communities with understanding how those decisions get made when a given local policy is brought forward in the planning process, DCOM developed the District Enforceable Policy Decision Tree. And I'll move then to that particular diagram here on slide 5. And as you can see, it is a multi-step, multi-layered process wherein a given request by a community must clear a number of hurdles. And it is not easy to get a local enforceable policy approved in the ACMP process. And part of the reason for that is because the ACMP program is just one part of a comprehensive regulatory system we have here in the state of Alaska, where a number of agencies, both state and federal, already are protecting certain air and water standards and resources of the state. The Department of Fish and Game has certain duties and obligations to protect resources. So I just want to acknowledge that it is difficult under the current system to have a local plan or local policy approved. The once you get through the local planning process and have a local plan approved, you then move into the application and implementation of those policies, and that occurs in the consistency review process. When somebody seeks to operate a project, a ship, conduct an activity in the coastal zone, they have to obtain a consistency determination from the Division of Coastal and Ocean Management. In conducting a review, the department works with a variety of stakeholders, and including the coastal districts. And coastal districts, in turn, receive implementation funding that's passed through from the federal government as part of the CZMA to implement and conduct those consistency reviews once their plans have been approved and are in place. Importantly, coastal districts are considered to have expertise in the interpretation of their plan, and that becomes important at a particular stage of the review process in the event consensus does not emerge among the reviewing entities. And also, importantly here, coastal districts can comment on a project using their local plan or the state's standards. So we do have some coastal districts here in the state that do not have either approved plans or have not attempted to develop a plan, and they are able to participate in the review process and have an impact on projects and development that occurs in their district. So I would like to then now turn to the review process itself. So we've talked about the development of local plans. We're now going to talk about the review process, the implementation of this program, and how it affects projects and activities. The again, as I stated, the review process itself involves the applicant, the affected coastal district, state agencies, federal agencies, and the public. The review process is designed to evaluate projects to protect and manage coastal uses and resources while addressing an applicant's project. And it's not meant to be a straight yes or no on whether a project can occur or move forward, but rather it's intended to massage a project, how it's executed or when it's executed or how it's designed, to get it into compliance with the consistent with the coastal management program at the beginning of the process, so that they can then move through that process, that permitting process, and be reflective and protective of the values of the local community. The first step here is to determine the applicability of ACMP to a project. If a project or activity is occurring in the coastal zone here in Alaska, then if that activity is occurring there and requires a state or federal authorization, or if it's a federal activity and there's a list of those, and it's located within the coastal zone, on federal lands within the coastal area, or on the OCS, then the ACMP may apply. And so when it does, the Division of Coastal and Ocean Management offers pre-review assistance before the review actually starts, where they confer with an applicant and identify the kinds of things that they're going to need to provide in order to conduct the consistency review. And the information in that the department is looking for then has to be categorized as complete. Once a complete application is brought into the department, the agency has to have all copies of permit applications, and when that application comes into the shop, DCOM has 21 days to determine whether or not the application is complete. And they use all of the information in that that application to determine the scope of the review. The scope of the consistency review is determined by DCOM and is determined by the type of project it is, whether it is engaged in federal agency activity associated with facilities that may that affect a coastal use or resource, if it's an activity that requires a federal agency authorization, and the activities associated with its facilities that may affect the resource, or certain activities that only require a state agency authorization, and the activity then is subject to the authorization. The scope can include low-impact activities as well as major developments, it really does run quite a wide spectrum. And one other thing to mention is that the coordinating agency is determined by the activities involved. More often than not, DCOM is the coordinating agency to conduct the review, mm-hmm. but sometimes when only a single permit is needed from a single agency, and that agency is not DNR, or it is a single division within DNR other than DCOM, then that agency can conduct the review itself.
Mr. Balash, just so you're aware, we have three other people that are following you, so we'll give you 5 minutes to go ahead and
okay.
Finish up, and then we'll have questions by members of the committee, and then we'll go on to the other presenters.
I think I can do that.
Thank you.
The division prepares the public notice for comment. That notice is published and in three public places, in a local circulating newspaper, and posted on the state's website. Included in the notice is information about the project, the comment deadlines, and any other milestones that are dictated by the project, and that means we've started day one. Importantly, there are two types of reviews, a 30-day review, a 50-day review. Not particularly important as to what those differences are to go through, but some of the more involved projects that have certain federal authorizations and our federal agency activities require that 50-day review. By day 13 or day 25 of that review, review participants can request additional information, and importantly here, they can also request to designate an area within the scope of that review. So in the case where a community doesn't have a designated area for natural hazards in their plan, or they don't have one approved, they can request during this review process that an area be designated, and the division can authorize that for purposes of that single review. And that has occurred here a handful of times. Let's just move on quickly then. At the deadline for public comments, all of the review participants may submit comments. They have to be received by day 17 or day 30. They must be in writing and explain whether the participant concurs with consistency or if they have determined that the project is inconsistent. And if it's inconsistent, they need to identify the enforceable policies that the project is inconsistent with, explain why, and propose alternatives. And that's a pretty important element here and something that comes into play in just a moment. DCOM then gathers all of those comments and considers what those comments reflect. And if the comments come back generally uniform and there's a consensus to that set of comments, everything goes pretty easy, but sometimes that consensus does not emerge. However, regardless of whether or not a given community has commented, whether or not they have an approved plan or have been afforded due deference, the goal here is to seek to find consensus, and that's an important element here. In those cases where consensus is not clear in the comments, they can convene a hearing. They attempt to resolve issues and facilitate some dialogue, and that might involve the project applicant. It might involve different agencies or different reviewers who have a difference of opinion. And at the end of the day, somebody, the reviewing entity, has to call the balls and strikes, and where there are differences, the division sides generally or attempts to look to and provide deference to the comments of the local district or the agency that has expertise on the issue that's in conflict. So DCOM then at day 24 proposes a determination of consistency, describes whether or not consistency has been achieved, and if not, what alternative measures are required by the applicant to achieve consistency. At that point, the applicant has some options. They can adopt the alternative measures and achieve consistency. They can otherwise modify the project to achieve consistency in some other way, or they can abandon the project and withdraw their application. again, that's where the applicant makes those particular choices. In addition, there is an opportunity at day 29 where a decision on consistency can be elevated to the commissioner, and that elevation can be brought by the applicant, or it can be brought by the affected coastal resource district. Elevations are handled as quickly as possible, but the statutes require them to be completed within 45 days, and then a final decision is issued by day 30 or day 50 of the consistency review process. There are such things as expedited reviews. They're achieved through a list of permits that are routine or generally consistent with associated activities in a given area. The ABC list is the common term that we use to describe that. And a point that I wanted to highlight for the committee is that while the administration is pleased with the program, wants to extend it for 6 years, we do understand that there is a desire on the part of communities and their legislators to substantively amend the statutes. And in considering that, Commissioner Sullivan worked with the governor to develop some guiding principles in order for us to engage constructively in the legislative process here. And the issues that are important to us and that will guide our engagement and decision making going forward is that we must maintain a predictable process for conducting those consistency reviews. We must maintain a strong state program where participant input is valued, but that ultimately the department, the commissioner, is making those final decisions. The standards and enforceable policies of the program must remain objective and must not duplicate or redefine existing authorities out there. We don't want to get into arguments over turf and who has jurisdiction over what things. And importantly, coastal districts should be afforded a meaningful role for input on these projects, but should not possess a veto decision over those projects.
Okay, thank you very much for your presentation. Any questions of Mr. Bailash by members of the committee? Thank you very much for coming out this afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mm-hmm.
Next, we have online Gary Williams from the Kenai Borough area. Mr. Williams, are you on, sir?
Yes, Chairman Olson.
Go ahead with your presentation, if you would.
Thank you, Chairman Olson, and members of the Senate Committee on Regional Affairs Committee. I appreciate your interest in the perspective of the Kenai Peninsula Borough's Coastal Management Program regarding this reauthorization of the Alaska Coastal Management Program. We believe the ACMP serves an important role in monitoring development in our young state and can become more meaningful with revised and improved legislation. I'd like to say, while I believe that the model currently in use by the ACMP needs to be reviewed to ensure that it's serving the best interest of the state of Alaska and its political subdivisions and industry, I believe the program can be enhanced with a few adjustments, and I'd like to confine my discussion to those adjustments. With regard to enforceable policy development, I'd focus on the Alaska Statute 4640. Within that, we find that coastal districts are disallowed enforceable policy if a matter is, quote, adequately addressed, unquote, in state or federal law. And what we've found is that the definition of adequately addressed, in our experience, is what DNR says it is, not state or federal agency actually administers a particular law that's on their books. And so I believe that this provision needs to be either removed or reworked. Also in AS 4640, many district policies have been disallowed because the policy did not, quote, flow from, unquote, specific state or federal law. The concept of flow from should be removed from the enforceable policy evaluation or provide that if a particular state or federal law does not address a local concern that the local governing body believes is important to the health and safety of the natural ecology, then the policy should be accepted. And then finally, with regard to AS 4640, it requires that a coastal district find that a specific coastal use is of, quote, unique concern, unquote, and to demonstrate that uniqueness by local usage or scientific evidence. What we've discovered at the level of documentation that DNR has required in terms of scientific evidence is burdensome because there is little scientific evidence, for example, in the designation of natural hazard areas. So the term unique concern is another one of those that's highly interpretable and should be removed from statute. So that's my discussion on enforceable policy development regarding statute changes. Now, my discussion on issues regarding the statewide standards, which are found in administrative code, is of some length. So I think I'll skip over that and simply fax to you this complete discussion for your review at another time. Well, what I'd like to point out is that the administrative code that was developed following the 2003 ACMP legislation was, even according to DNR, more restrictive than statute required. And the result is that current regulations severely limit the ability of coastal districts to obtain policy approval from the DNR because the statewide standards have narrowed or eliminated, in some cases, the purview of coastal districts regarding certain coastal uses and resources. So, in sum, a few fixes to the statute with an eye to allowing a correction to administrative code will help make the ACMP more meaningful as an adjunct to state agency oversight of the resources of our vast and diverse land. And so, we recommend reauthorization of the ACMP and encourage the Senate to pass a six-year extension. That is my testimony, Chairman Olson.
Well, thank you very much for coming out this afternoon and presenting. Any questions by members of the committee for Mr. Williams? If not, I've got a couple of questions, sir. One has to do with the facilitation of plan approval. If we go ahead and do either the removal or the reworking of the adequately addressed portion of ACE, Alaska Statute 4640, and the unique concern that you talked about as far as the level of documentation, you think that'll decrease the frustration that many of these people have with their plans being rejected?
I think so, and I think it will help DNR as well. They're trying to figure out how to interpret these words as they relate to providing approvals. So I see it as an absolute win-win for DNR and its ability to try to help districts to create their policies consistent with state law, and will help districts understand why in some cases they don't get a policy and help them develop more consistent policies. It's a win-win.
Okay. The other question has to do with the policy council that was done away with back in 2003. What are your thoughts and ideas on reestablishing that council?
I'm hopeful that we can reestablish the council. And the reason simply is that it's very difficult on our end to work with an agency that writes the rules and interprets them. And with all due respect to the staff at DCOM, whom I respect and we have a good cordial relationship, it's a tough job. They've had a very tough time being able to try to make this a workable program based upon the poor quality and, frankly, legislation that they had to work with. I think that having a policy board that helps to mediate some of the issues that both sides have would be a great adjunct to our program.
Okay. Any further questions of Mr. Williams by members of the committee? If not, thank you very much for coming out this afternoon and presenting.
Thank you, Senator.
Next, we have Tom Lohman from the North Slope Borough. Mr. Lohman, are you on, sir?
Yes, I am. Good afternoon, Chairman Olson and members of the committee. My name is Tom Lohman. I've worked for the North Slope Borough now for almost 24 years going back beyond the final 1988 approval of our North Slope Borough's now lapsed local district coastal management plan. I want to begin my comments today by expressing my strong belief that the state's long-term best interests are served by the continuation and amendment of the current ACMP to restore a meaningful role in the program for coastal districts and the communities and residents they represent. It's important, I think, to dispel some of the persistent myths that surround the ACMP and the 8 years of efforts by districts and others to seek important and necessary changes after the crippling amendments that were adopted in 2003. First and foremost, I think it's important to realize that the districts, the constituents that you all represent, are not anti-development. The ACMP is not an anti-development program. The districts do not now and never have sought veto authority over development projects in their regions. We are not seeking to in any way usurp state or federal authority or in some way impinge upon the separation of powers between branches or levels of government. Despite there being repeated, you know, these myths being repeated time and again in legislative hearings and elsewhere, there are simply no facts to back up any of these false claims. The citizens of Alaska are generally as pro-development, I think, as the representatives they elect to serve them. In the North Slope Borough, we are as dependent upon a healthy oil and gas industry as the state as a whole is to maintain the hard-won quality of life for our people and the provision of essential services to our communities. At its heart, the ACMP can really be a development program, a program that provides a meaningful role for your communities in a coordinated project review process is designed to get to yes. What districts used to enjoy and what we want again is the opportunity to work with project applicants and review agencies to influence project designs in a way that draw upon local expertise and address local concerns. An ACMP that truly reflects a partnership between the centralized state government and the far-flung and diverse communities of our state would actually enhance the likelihood that projects will be permitted more smoothly. We in the districts, I think, find it ironic that a common theme heard from the state administration these days is that Alaska is special, unique, and poorly understood by remote federal decision makers, and that those decision makers should not impose their will with respect to actions in our backyard. And all we're asking for is the same measure of respect from our state government that our state government is demanding from the federal government. I want to close by addressing just a couple of shades of meaning that you heard in some of the earlier testimony and that DNR has testified in other forums on. First, it's been said that the statewide subsistence standard requires that projects avoid, minimize, or mitigate impacts to subsistence, and that's not exactly true. The statewide standard doesn't have alternative measures for mitigation, and that's a problem because you have to either thumbs up or thumbs down in your policies. You either have to approve or disapprove of a certain action. So the districts can't be where we want to be with some of our policies, and I think maybe that's where this idea of veto comes from. If you look at some of the North Slope Borough's proposed policies that were rejected by the state, we used language that said certain activities were allowed or certain activities were disallowed. We didn't want to go there, but the state required us to go there by saying we had to either allow or disallow an activity. Second, it's been said that you don't need an area designation in order to consider impacts to subsistence. And that's not true. The subsistence standard only applies if there are approved designated areas. So without a designation, DNR has no way to consider comments about impacts to subsistence. Third, there's also been testimony that what we districts perceive as ever-changing standards and rules throughout the last 8 years that we've been asked to meet varying standards have not really, in fact, been changes in those standards, just merely the provision of more specifics by DNR. And respectfully, I would argue that that's not true as well, that I'll note in that respect that sample approvable policies offered several times over the past 8 years by DNR as the types of policies that could be approved by districts were later removed from consideration and similar policies were rejected. Likewise, we heard repeatedly during the last session that there was some mysterious legal constraint on the district's ability to adopt policies, and an AG opinion, I believe, was requested but was never received or issued. And that argument seems to have gone away, which is good because I don't believe there was prior to 03 or now any mysterious legal constraint on our ability to craft enforceable policies. DNR has acknowledged, with respect to the designated area requirement, that an unintended consequence arising from the inability to make designations on federal lands or waters. For certain issues critical to us in the North Slope, like subsistence, you have to designate in order to apply your policies. And we can't do that in the enormous areas of NPRA or on the OCS. So we've effectively been closed out from crafting subsistence policies in the areas that are of greatest concern to us. We've also heard about, from my colleague, Mr. Williams, down in Kenai, this do loop, this unintended, perhaps, do loop between the adequately addressed requirement and this flow from requirement. Something that is adequately addressed is not appropriate for a local policy, but local policies must flow from a statewide standard. And if they flow from a statewide standard just a little too directly in the viewpoint of DCOM, well, then they're adequately addressed. So the standard is out. Also cited by Deputy Commissioner Balash was the opportunity for districts to designate areas on the fly during review as a positive aspect of the current program. And to me, with respect, that seems to fly in the face of industry concerns and one of DNR's guiding principles for engagement that he described, that the program be predictable and that the applicable standards and policies be clear up front. Finally, the administration and many industry representatives who have commented on this issue have argued that the 6 years embodied in the bill that's been introduced require 6 more years of careful stakeholder deliberation as necessary to identify appropriate changes to the ACMP that would address district concerns. And I can't tell you how frustrating it is to hear that. We and other districts have, in good faith, Deputy Commissioner Balash's words, engaged and spent enormous sums of money and enormous amounts of staff time for 8 long years now, participating in an endless series of workshops, multi-stakeholder meetings, program reevaluation meetings, a federal review of the program, a legislative audit, and hearing after hearing here in Juneau. I suggest that the time is now to fix this program. And with that, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'll conclude my testimony, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Do we have any questions by members of the committee for Mr. Lohman?
No.
If not, Mr. Lohman, I've got a couple questions. You said your last comment was the time is now to go ahead and fix this. If there is obviously an impasse here where either the legislature and the governor cannot get together and we do allow it to sunset, what are your thoughts on that perspective, on that occurrence on June 30th?
Well, Mr. Chairman, our mayor, I think Mayor Itta of the North Slope Borough is on record as saying if the program remains unchanged, we in the North Slope, with respect to my colleagues in other districts, we have nothing to lose. We have no local district plan. We have no policies. And again, with respect to Deputy Commissioner Balash and the good folks who work at DCOM, the idea that deference is paid to local communities may be the case elsewhere, but I haven't seen awfully much of it in our reviews. We've conducted 3 elevations since the 03 amendments. And in each case, not only were the views of the North Slope Borough not adopted in those elevations, but they were paid virtually no attention in the final decision of the commissioner. Very, very quick, very, very cursory decisions that essentially ignored all the points. And to give you an idea of why we think this program is so valuable and why it should not be viewed as an anti-development program, 2 of those elevations involved Shell offshore operations in the Beaufort and Chukchi. And some might argue that, well, there's grounds for preventing the North Slope Borough from getting a local plan, because look what they tried to do. They tried to stop Shell. And that's not the case at all. We, I think, through our participation with Shell, raised a number of points through the consistency review that were ignored by DNR up the chain through a commissioner elevation. And now, years later, working directly with the company, we're where we wanted to be in a lot of respects. And I would argue to Shell and to the state administration that if we had this program to assist us in coordinating our review of all of these issues, and providing that roadmap to that company of what our concerns were up front, it may not have taken 5 years to get where we are. And that's where coastal management can actually assist in project permitting.
Okay. And as you look at the program as it is, there's obviously two bills that we're going to be hearing next Tuesday to extend the program as it currently exists. What are the minimum changes that you think need to be done in order to make this this program acceptable to people throughout the state of Alaska?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think doing away with the designated area requirement, which has cost us an extraordinary amount of money trying to map an area the size of the North Slope. Again, we had no idea that when we embarked on that process that we were going to have to designate, for instance, for subsistence for each particular species and each particular subsistence practice across an area, you know, the size of Minnesota. Extraordinarily expensive, doesn't seem to sort of accomplish the goal that was intended, and we can't designate on federal land. So number one, I think getting rid of the designated area requirement, addressing that do loop between adequately addressed and flow from, doing away with those requirements. I think the board that Mr. Williams talked about, bringing back something like the Coastal Policy Council that existed prior to 2003 would be a very positive step. I acknowledge, I think that there were some problems with the previous CPC, but the bills in last session that discussed a board of somewhat different makeup and somewhat different responsibilities that would not be involved in the review of individual projects would be a very positive step.
And can you comment on what kind of, what, with that in mind, what kind of makeup of the board, of this policy council would you like to see on there? Last time around, they were pretty much designees from the governor. How would you like to see it?
Well, going back to the CPC, Mr. Chairman, going back to the Coastal Policy Council pre-2003, I believe you had it was somewhat stacked in favor, if you want to call it that, of the local communities, and you had to have local elected officials from, I think, 9 regions of the state, and then you had 5 state officials. The problem, I believe, with that system, and there were some problems, is that you had elected officials who may not have been particularly familiar with, you know, issues elsewhere in the state and may not even have had particular expertise for various projects in their own areas. I think a makeup that would provide for representation by the districts, and you know, I wouldn't argue that there needed to be a majority of district representation, but representation of state agencies, districts, and perhaps other stakeholders as well beyond simply the districts and the agencies, would provide a balanced review of, again, not individual projects, but a balanced review of the approval of local district plans and policies and amendments to the state program.
Okay. One final question I have for you. With the new commissioner that's come on board, are you more optimistic that we can work things out, or you think it's going to be business as normal?
Oh, not at all. Mr. Chairman, I have great respect for Commissioner Sullivan. I think he has been extraordinarily candid in saying that there's a learning curve, and he's marching up it as he is prone to do. As Mr. Williams said, there are good people working in DNR and DCOM. Mr. Balash is one of them who has, you know, I think, intimate knowledge of this program. I think the pieces are in place. And there's been 8 years of work to identify the concerns of the districts, and the pieces are in place to throw that switch and move forward and get this program back where it needs to be without this unnecessary fear of Alaskans. People, you know, there seems to be a little bit of fear-mongering that somehow people out in the communities are going to try to halt the economy of the state, and it's just not the case. And I've said before in a number of settings that there are a few folks down there in DCOM, Randy Bates being, I guess, the primary one, that know this program better than anybody and know how to fix it better than anybody. And if he gets his marching orders from the folks up on the third floor, I think it can happen quickly and it can happen in a meaningful way.
Mr. Lohman, thank you very much for coming out this afternoon.
Mr. Chairman.
No further questions. My members of the committee, we have Kathy Wasserman next to come on up from the Municipal League. Ms. Wasserman, identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Kathy Wasserman. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Municipal League. First of all, the Municipal League certainly supports the extension of this program. This program has been a cornerstone of many municipalities throughout the years. We did not realize back pre-2003 that we were actually a part of what the administration might call the instability of the program. And certainly that is not ever most municipalities' intents. First of all, I'll start with the sunset. ACMP is the only program that provides financial assistance to municipalities and coastal districts and a regulatory framework for them to have a seat at the table in the management decisions that affect their own coastal zone. We feel that as municipalities and districts, why would we not want to have a seat at that table that impact the people that live in our communities? The enforceable policies, most communities and or districts have lost most of their enforceable policies and are left with those that are so limiting they are ineffective. And this is the cornerstone of the program itself. Another issue that we have is the DEC carve-out. Not permitting any enforceable policies or comments that relate to air or water quality has virtually eliminated most of the meaningful participation in the ACMP. Since almost all coastal uses relate to air or water quality, DEC, as a rule, does not communicate with municipalities and coastal districts, so we think that they should be brought back into the ACMP review process, and coastal districts need to be able to comment on those air and water quality issues. The designated air areas, requiring that any physical area subject to either subsistence or habitat enforceable policies must be pre-designated before any impacts to coastal resources or uses can be considered, ignores the reality that resources and habitats occur throughout the entire coastal area, and many are migratory. Project reviews are site-specific, and many of the resources move around, such as fish, deer, caribou. Designating areas rather than resources or uses themselves is unrealistic. This regulation should be eliminated. Another issue is consultants. DECOM has a policy of not allowing coastal districts or municipalities to hire consultants to assist local districts using the 306 funding. If a coastal district wishes to contract for services rather than hire staff, that should be a local decision, as long as they get the work done that's required by the state. Municipalities and districts that care enough to take part in this program have always tried to balance responsible development with protection of the coastal environment. Municipalities are eager to return to the table and participate in a re-energized, coordinated review process which has been lost since the, quote, streamlined ACMP process was implemented. The revisions that districts and municipalities have had to adopt are merely a shell compared to those we had in 2003. I guess I'm surprised that so many people have just assumed that municipalities and districts want to stop development. The further out you get into the rural communities, as you well know, Mr. Chairman, the more development those rural communities are looking for in order to stay alive. And I don't think anyone has the intent of stopping any development. We just want to be at the table to look at these things early on before things start to happen so we can all discuss it. We also have never asked or requested veto power. We simply want to be at the table with the state, the applicant, and anyone else involved. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions by members of the committee for Ms. Wasserman? If not, thank you very much for coming out this afternoon.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else who wants to comment on the ACMP issue? Any other departments want to comment on the part of the ACMP issue? With that, thank you very much for coming out this afternoon. I want to just announce that our next meeting is going to be on Tuesday. We'll be bringing up two bills, Senate Bill 46 and Senate Bill 45. At that time, if there's nothing else to come before the committee, we're adjourned.